WTY.com.
I'll stand by you. I'll stand by you. Won't let nobody hurt you. I'll stand by you.
Welcome back to The Cabin. This is the Up North Podcast. I'm Kirk Bankstead along with Pat Kreitlow and Kristen Lyerly.
You're soft, Kirk Bankstead, as we found out in the first segment. You're very soft. That's why you picked that music. It was lovely and soothing.
Oh, I'm not taking credit for that. That's Pat. Pat's just as soft as I am. He picked the serenade waltzy music for the third
we're
block.
We're going to talk about somebody who stands with other people in this segment, yes.
Right, right. And these people are not soft. So I just have to say, as an OBGYN, it's never a surprise when I talk about women's health because I talk about it all the time. I have boundaries issues. But it's not just doctors who are concerned about the potential repeal of abortion rights under Roe v. Wade. It's all of us. Including, you might not think there's not as much concern about amongst evangelical Christians, but you'd be very wrong. There's actually a really storied history of clergy involving abortion rights. And Pat, you did a story about this on Up North News.
Yeah, we put the story up. It actually originated with our sister outlets in Michigan and North Carolina. But it follows the Reverend Katie Zay, who shares her faith journey from an evangelical upbringing in the South to becoming CEO now of the Religious Coalition for Reproductive Choice. There's a narrative out there that says most people of faith oppose abortion. And while members of the Christian right have been the most vocal, the most aggressive of measures to restrict access, polling repeatedly finds that a majority of Americans who follow a religious tradition, including Catholics, Protestants, and non-evangelicals, support abortion being legal. And our story includes the latest from a Pew survey that found 66% of Black Protestants, 60% of white non-evangelical Protestants, 56% of Catholics support abortion being legal. So we have this interview with Reverend Katie Zay, a pro-choice pastor who lives in North Carolina now, and talked about how she came to her pro-choice views, why this is central to her faith. She wanted to demystify the intersection of faith and abortion and better understand why so many people wrongly believe that to be religious or follow a faith means you're anti-abortion. Let's hear a little bit of what she told us.
When I arrived at the clinic, I was assumed to be a patient there to have an abortion, which was a very impactful experience for me because I felt what it felt like to have Christian people like me yelling at me, telling me not to go inside. It was very unsettling for me. I had the most sacred experience of watching the nurses and the doctors and the staff care for patients. And as a result of that tour, I decided I wanted to volunteer there weekly. I felt like I have to find a way to bridge these two worlds because there's a narrative out there about what it means to be a person of faith and to have opinions about abortion and didn't reflect my own. So that really was kind of the origin story of why I do this work.
So we're gonna hear more about from her in just a second, but I wanted to back up and say that this was after she had gone to seminary and that she was on campus providing some pastoral care training in how to accompany someone making a reproductive decision about a pregnancy or who's experiencing a loss. And she realized that to do that, you have to go where people are experiencing abortions. She contacted a local health center. And like she said, it was interesting that here's this devout Christian having all these other so-called devout Christians, you know, yelling at her, basically heckling her, thinking that, you know, she's a woman that's going in for an abortion. She saw about the stigma that's involved. And so in our next clip here, she talks a bit more about that. And then you hear from one of our reporters, Kimberly Lawson, explaining more about the history and the intertwining of how the Republican Party somehow in the 1970s decided to embrace these anti-choice views. Let's listen in.
If you look at the sacred text, there's actually very little speaking to this issue of abortion. If anything, there are pro-abortion texts in the Hebrew Bible specifically, and really nothing in the Christian text.
People of faith are often assumed to be anti-abortion, even though the Bible is mum on the issue. In reality, Research shows that a majority of Americans who follow religious tradition support abortion being legal. So how do we come to believe that most people of faith oppose abortion? In the 1970s, Republican political operatives realized they could weaponize abortion rights, which many grassroots religious activists already opposed, in order to build a voting bloc comprised of Catholics, Protestants, and Mormons to elect Republicans.
That kind of became the central, one of the pieces of the central platform of their white Christian nationalist agenda to get conservative politicians elected. And it's been incredibly successful.
The quote, Christian right has spent more than 40 years waging war on abortion rights. And their success obscures the fact that they represent a minority belief in the United States.
Because it's been weaponized and intertwined with this really well-orchestrated political machine around this white Christian nationalist agenda, they've done such a good job of amplifying what is really a fringe belief and making it seem like that is the only belief that's out there, when in reality, there is no one understanding of, is abortion right or wrong? There's a lot of theological diversity on this, especially among different religious traditions.
And so one more thing before I ask Kirk and Kristen to jump in here. She says it's a calling from the divine that it was just so sacred to accompany people through a very vulnerable moment, which for her, as someone who follows the model of Jesus, that's what she sees him doing. He showed up for people during their most difficult moments, offered them care and compassion and love, and he spoke up against unjust laws. So for her, it was a natural fit to do the work. She says, I know some people won't understand, but for me, it makes complete sense. And I'm glad we wove into that story the polling data that makes her point that, you know, that's a majority viewpoint. It's a fringe. It's a non-minority view that's making the most noise and now threatening 50 years, Chris, of reproductive rights.
Yeah, it's so true. And I think you really captured it in that piece. It's shocking to me how religion has gone so far with this connection to the anti-abortion movement, so far in this bizarre direction. Because early on, when Roe first came out, right around the time of Roe, the first consultation service for abortion care was established by pastors and rabbis in New York City. They recognized what was happening to women and families because of this, and they created this. It was published in the New York Times. It was like an ad. If you're in trouble, call us. And these pastors were on call, and women would call, and they would vet clinics, and they would find places for these people to go so they could get the urgent health care that they needed. So religion and abortion have actually been very closely intertwined in this country. And it's only when Paul Weyrich was so clever, he was looking for that issue that he could win that block of voters with.
And he's a historic figure in terms of being a right-wing political operative. He basically invented political direct mail in the mid-70s.
Yes, and he's from Wisconsin, sadly. Mm-hmm. So there's another connection. And he very cleverly used Ronald Reagan, who had incidentally just signed one of the most liberal abortion laws, like pro-abortion laws, into law in California. But Reagan was always conflicted, and Weyrich recognized how savvy he was and how charismatic he was. And he was able to use Jerry Falwell and Reagan and a number of different leaders to turn this into the issue that it is today. And it is profoundly terrible, and it hurts women and families and communities.
So my thoughts on this is I'm not surprised to hear the statistics that a majority of Christians in many different faiths, even Catholics, are opposed to overturning Roe. I'm not surprised because I've been forced to go to church since I was like a baby, because my dad always directed choirs, and then I've sung professionally in church choirs my whole life. So I've been in church since I was like a little kid in Wisconsin, Boston, California, Chicago, and every church I've ever gone to, I haven't been in the South. And so I was thinking maybe these folks are all in the South because I don't know anything about the South. But every place I've been to in the Midwest, on the West Coast, and in the Northeast, preaches helping those that are less fortunate. Exactly, like helping those to go through a time of trial, being a good, you know, holding somebody's hand, you know. And so that's the Christianity that I know. I helping the meek, you know, all that stuff. And so all of this hardcore, like mean Christianity, I just don't understand. And I always thought it must be the South because I just don't understand the South. But it exists in Wisconsin too, but I don't go to those churches.
And it's like she said in the clip, I mean, what do you know about Jesus? You know, did Jesus walk around and judge people? No, it was the opposite of that. Jesus was like, you're hungry? Here's a fish. Here's a pole. Let me teach you how. So all of this, the way that they've been able to co-opt this is just, it's unbelievable. And when you think about it, it doesn't make any sense, but we don't think about it that way.
No. So that's how politics has crept into something that, again, we're just waiting on a U.S. Supreme Court decision and whether it matches what was leaked or if something else comes of it. Time for one other topic in this segment, and it also is something from Up North News. I want to mention, if you wanted to see those clips again or hear them or read the story, go to upnorthnewswi.com or upnorthnewswi, search for that on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and we have those clips on there as well. In today's newsletter, I wrote an editorial, which turned out to be way longer than I was planning on, but as I was thinking about the January 6th committee hearing, which is going to be in prime time Thursday night, I thought, you know, this is not some kind of a one-off deal. This was not just like, you know, a demonstration that got out of hand. It's become clear and will become more clear Thursday night that was only one part of a concerted effort to basically stage a coup and in other ways to undermine democracy, undermine public confidence in democracy. And so I thought, well, we should remind people of some of the things that have gone on besides the January 6th riot. So guys, I'm going to start this list, and I hope it doesn't run into the commercial break. There were the early lawsuits rooted in absolutely zero evidence of fraud. Mm-hmm. There was we've all forgotten Senator Ron Johnson's circus-like conspiracy-based hearing about a month after the election. There was Ron Johnson, as we talked about on the show here recently, admitting in a phone call that he knew Biden won, but that it would be political suicide to say so publicly. There was Tom Tiffany and Scott Fitzgerald voting to deny the lawfully cast votes submitted and certified by other states. There was Tiffany supporting a Texas lawsuit to disregard voters and simply award Wisconsin's electoral votes to Trump, something for which we wrote an editorial and continue to maintain Tiffany should resign or be expelled for signing on to that lawsuit. There's the fraudulent slate of electors, the fake electors that were put forward in Wisconsin and other states, including Robert Spindell, who was and remarkably still is a member of the Wisconsin Elections Commission.
And could be voted to be in charge of the WEC when they vote next week.
That's right. There was the three-ring circus of conspiracy theorists allowed to perform over and over again for the Assembly Elections Committee. The attack on ballot drop boxes, which Republicans were for until they lost an election, and now suddenly they're against. The Republican sheriff in Racine County trying to get Elections Commission members charged with a crime for daring to help elderly voters stay safe during a pandemic. There was Ron Johnson calling on Republican leaders in the legislature to simply take over election administration and ignore the Wisconsin Elections Commission. You now have every major Republican candidate for governor saying they would abolish the Wisconsin Elections Commission, which was created by Republicans when they got rid of the Government Accountability Board because its investigations were getting too close to things that Scott Walker was doing. And then finally, the cherry on top, the dumpster fire, the incompetence of the investigation done by Michael Gableman. There are too many things to name here, but his team even most recently botched a potential interview by using an unlicensed attorney. So as you can see, this is not one bad day at the U.S. Capitol. This is something where a former president and the leadership of a major American political party are willing to break the law or break the country in order to seize power. We can't wish that away. We can't just turn the page. So I hope people watch and listen Thursday night because you haven't heard everything yet, Kirk.
Pat, I have been drinking wine on this show, but I'm always red. But what that last 4 minutes of this radio show made me beet red, because now I'm really mad.
Mm-hmm.
It's ridiculous what we've had to go through as a country and as a state. Our state is the worst. The New York Times listed us as there's more people running, more Republicans running for office that are committed to the big lie in Wisconsin than almost any other state in the union. And it's ongoing. It's an ongoing assault on the truth. And it makes me red, even though I'm drinking wine.
Well, and it's big stuff. I mean, it's not like little subtle stuff. I mean, these are big monumental things that are happening. Like, I wanted to give you oxygen there for a minute, Pat, as you were reading these things out, because I was like, this is just so much. But we're so nice. We have such a hard time talking about politics. And you bring this up in mixed company, even in a careful way. And people don't want to address it. They don't want to acknowledge it. They just want to like go back to their corners and pretend it never happened. And I think that's the thing that frustrates me the most. Like, this is really happening. We need to talk about it because our democracy is literally at stake and it's happening right here.
Go ahead, Kirk.
And people are ginning up to capitalize on all this uncertainty out of our elections. It's being ginned up, and come November, there's going to be an army of people that are going to say that the elections aren't real and are fraudulent. It's going to happen
unless
again.
Unless they win. Then suddenly, there wasn't any problem. Kind of like Ron Johnson continues to go after Hunter Biden. Nobody talks about Hillary Clinton anymore. Well, that's because she's not near power anymore. Isn't that coincidental that now they're going after Hunter Biden, the son of the president? It seems so odd.
Tomorrow night, Hillary's emails are going to come back up again. They're going to pull all the old rabbits out of the hat.
We are going to go find something more happier to talk about right after we take 2 minutes to catch our breath to wrap up the show. You're up north.